This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. 7 legendary titles including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. Joining him is everyone's favorite coach and hair model, Chris, aka Tex McQuilkin, Power Athlete's Director of Performance. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Look at you, all business. Well, dude, thanks for joining. Welcome, visitor. Just, you know, showing up, driving out from Carolina. I mean, where's the road going to take you next?
I'm going to be in Austin until probably Tuesday, maybe longer. There's some folks here that I want to connect with further. I mean, the entrepreneurial research is kind of where I'm at, you know. Like we talked just before, just getting out of the comfort zone and exploring other options outside of the basic realm of, and I say basic, it's not basic, but the subsidized government education system is essentially where I've spent most of my time.
Yeah,
you know, after playing college ball, I mean, the professional realm is not quite that, but still highly bureaucratic and very structured.
So you played at FAU. And then, you know, obviously played college football, and then you got to go play in the NFL for 3-4 years.
Yeah.
And then once your NFL career, you know, obviously due to injury, for those of you guys who know, had a kind of an interesting surgery based on what was like adductor groin.
Yeah.
Like, I remember you telling me about it and being like, that seems like a terrible fucking idea. But yeah, unfortunately, you listened to doctors.
It's pretty gnarly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's like, That was like the origin story, essentially, of getting into coaching.
Yeah.
You know, dad was a coach, so I knew it growing up, and coaches in my life were all uncles and surrogate fathers, you know. So high school football coach in the state of Florida, Larry Laskowski, you know, to me, he was my hero, you know. So I had kind of job training, right, kind of my entire life. And started playing football at like 4 or 5, you know, and I loved it. That was to a degree, kind of the pinnacle of existence. So, you know, watching Cash watch you and having some experience with that, it's pretty sweet, man.
You sat there and watched us with our Lego building,
dude. That was awesome.
Yeah, it's so funny. That was like awesome. He's the foreman. I'm the shop
hand. I really felt like just honored to just witness that, man. Mandalorian last night was pretty cool too.
Yeah.
So dad, right? He's dad. So yeah. Football was the path. I mean, it was laid out.
The way.
It was.
This is the way.
The way. Interesting. Yeah. So, where was I going with that?
Oh, you're saying uncles, dads, I mean, football, right. You know, on the job training.
Right. So laid out the path. I had an angle there. So when I got to college, when I got into college and started playing football, this is where I was going. I kept everything. I kept all the notebooks and all the, we didn't have, it's a little bit ironic that I got into strength and conditioning. Origin story is where I was talking about. So I kept everything because I kind of assumed that the football coaching route was gonna be the route. But I didn't just want to do it just because it was the easy route, right? But I wanted to keep things just in case. So I got an opportunity after college to play in the National Football League. And what an organization to get an opportunity with. Tony Dungy was the head coach at the time, and Bill Polian was the GM. That Indianapolis Colts offense was epic, man. They're Hall of Fame dudes
and
all over the place.
And a good defense.
A fast, aggressive, undersized. Yeah. And that's why, when my agent called me right after the draft and said, hey, Kansas City, Jacksonville, Indy, and a couple other ones for minicamp invites, but these guys want to give you a contract. Indianapolis wasn't necessarily the highest amount, but looking at the roster, and I'm a 5'9", that was 220-pound, dude, and looking at their linebackers, Gary Brackett was like 5'10", yeah. Bob Sanders was 5'8.5", Cato June was a Will that played safety in college, they moved him down in the box, and so
Robert Mathis was a rusher, that's 235.
Maybe
235.
So it's like, okay, this could be a really good...
Like Dwight Freeney was their biggest dude.
Right, and like 245.
Yeah, 245, 250.
The career at FAU is kind of, they put our team in the Hall of Fame in 2008. In 2003, it was our third year playing football. And we ended up going 11-3. We go 4-6 year one, 2-9 year two, 11-3 year three. So make this massive turnaround. And almost get to the national championship. We lose to Colgate in the semifinals down in Boca, and it's kind of ironic because FAU just got beat in the Final Four, and so that was a semifinal game. They got beat in the Final Four. We got beat in the Final Four 20 years ago, 2003. Mm-hmm. It's a 1AA school at the time, so who gives a shit, right? But to us, it was the pinnacle. And then our senior year, we transitioned to 1A. And so we couldn't go to the bowl, but we ended up going 9-3, and beat some damn good teams. And so I had a solid career in college, looking back, in many respects because of the situation I was in and the coaches that were there. And so the reputation, and we talked about this past couple of days, and we were old school, man. Like the stuff they were doing. If we put the kind of volume on the kids that we were put on ourselves in those off season, even in season. I mean, it wouldn't fly in this day and age. I tried a couple times over the course of the past 14 years to hint at that, and guys will respond. Like we didn't talk about this too. Like kids can be soft, but if they don't know anything else, and you keep accumulating stress and keep accumulating volume, and they recover, then. The human organism is pretty dynamic, but it was old school, and I played in every game, so I didn't miss a game, and was the all-time leading tackle when I left. But it was more just because the scheme and the defense. Anyway, got a chance to play in many cases because of that. So Bill Polian had a lot of respect for Howard Schnellenberger and the way he did deals. So when I got up there, it just felt like home. It felt like an organization where I could spend 10 years. Russ Pennell was the special teams coordinator, and he and I had a really strong relationship, and in that off season, moving into the 2005 season, man, I had things were going in the right direction. And said, told this briefly last night, the first play of the 2005 season, I'm running down on kickoff and separate my damn AC joint on the first fucking snap, it was the left as well. So your kickball accident brought back some flashbacks. It's a tough deal. It's a tough deal. I missed
career ending.
Well, it wasn't, but it surely put a pause on things. Missed the second preseason game. It was game two. We had five that year. Played in the next three, but like kind of, you know, man, you kind of banged up in your foot. And I kind of needed every. Anyway, so I make practice squad that year. I don't make the active.
Yeah.
A couple times I was you know real close to being brought up a couple games because we were a little banged up mid season to late season, but didn't get activated at all. And like mid to late season, I started developing this kind of like tightness in the lower abdominal region. So pubic symphysis, that area. And we had six guys on the roster that were developing these things. And they had a couple of procedures the year before as well. And John Terrine, the head strength coach at the time, who's now running an I-9 up in Jersey, Richard Howell, who's the assistant, who's now the head strength coach, you know, because I'm a pretty cerebral guy, and I'm wanting to know what's going on. Like, why is this shit happening, you know? So their theory is, like, because they were undersized and because they ran so fast and so dynamic that we stressed, like, this lower abdominal, lower pelvic region. But they call it a sports hernia. But they did an MRI, and looking back, what it was is tendonitis.
Yeah.
That's all it was. It was tendonitis of...
The pubic bone.
The pubic bone.
Yeah.
So all the connective tissue, you mentioned it yesterday, training the BJJ guys.
Yeah.
The fascia, the like, feel all that stuff. And it's intense, man. There's a lot of stuff going on there.
Yeah.
So their procedure, and Donovan McNabb was kind of the popular guy that did that the year before, I think. So people are like, yeah, this is the new thing. And I'm an NFL like player, and I'm lucky to be there. So whatever you guys tell me to do, man, I'm all in. And so, you know, we do this procedure. And they also have the procedure they call an adductor release, where they actually cut fascia.
Yeah.
At the time, I knew none of this, because I was just, you know, let's get it fixed, let's go into the off season, let's rehab, and let's roll. Their concept for me was, okay, you're maybe a little bit small for the National Football League at linebacker, but we got a guy, Bob Sanders, is a pretty good football player, and we think he could be kind of in that realm as well. Ran pretty fast and pretty aggressive dude. And so I transitioned to safety that offseason after rehabbing a surgery. And things were going okay, you know. I had a good OTAs, and back in those days, man, we were there all summer pretty much.
Yeah.
And like day five of training camp 2006, you know, I'm battling for the backup spot in 06 for Bob. And he's a little banged up like he always was, so I didn't get a chance to play quite a bit that year if things go well. So what ended up happening is I tore the adductor off the bone. Like, the pubic symphysis was kind of fine. I mean, it's a little bit tight now, and even 15 years later.
Well, you know, it was the fact that you weren't using it. You know, the fact that you rehabbed, like, they're like, oh, it did this, or it was the fact that you just rested me and I didn't train.
Say again now?
you know, with the tendonitis, you just rest it. So, like, it was probably the fact that you'd never taken a break.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you got a year to heal.
Yeah. There's a lot of things going back, because essentially we got into this because the origin story. Because to me, we cut people open, right, in our country maybe a little bit too much.
Yeah.
And I say maybe just to be kind, but like, man, the amount of procedures we do in coaching college ball and being around high school kids as well, I mean, it's just so quick. Because we're always looking for a quick answer, right? Like what's going to get me back, like, right away? And you know, at that time, too, you know, I think the society at large is a lot more trusting of doctors, maybe. I think the COVID situation maybe has...
Oh, shit, you didn't know me. I didn't trust those people from day one.
Well, good for you.
I got lied to early on.
Good for you.
So you end up tearing the adductor off the bone, which is a nasty fucking...
It was gnarly, bro. Yeah. Like, black and blue all the way down to the calf. The testicles were swollen. And they're telling me... Yeah, it's probably just scar tissue breaking up, you know? And I'm going, yeah, I hope so. So I have this, like, calcified thing in that adductor region that developed about 2 months after the surgery now. So I got the pelvic floor repaired, and they cut the fascia of the adductor tendon, and that's where we developed this scar tissue. And I didn't really notice it until, like, again, like 2 months into it. And I'm like, what the fuck is this shit? Like, why is this happening? So they brought the surgeon back in, and he's like, "Oh, yeah, that's a pretty intense scarring that you got going on, but it should be a big deal." You know, he put a couple shots of cortisone in it, thinking it was going to,
you know,
and maybe that weakened it. Who knows? But either way, it tore off the bone, and so, but we didn't get an MRI right away. 3-4 days later, I go back and try it again, a special teams practice, and it pops worse. And then we get an MRI. It retracted, I think it's like 5 or 6 centimeters, something like that. So, like, you go, and I haven't, like, told this story much because you're reliving this moment. Like, you go from, like, this is going to be my career. This is going to be 10 years at least, man. Like, because football's football. Wherever you go, like, can you learn a playbook? Can you be trustworthy? And are you durable and consistent enough to last? And all those things were right on, except the durability. And I just, you know, and so existentially, right? It was like a crisis moment, relative crisis moment for me, to be so close and taste. And I almost at that time, I was almost like, I wish I wouldn't have even had the opportunity. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because you're there and you start getting paid pretty well, and it's like, man, you're seeing this, you know, this future. And so, yeah, I got knocked on the ass there. And then when I was back home in Boca, where I went to school, I started asking questions, you know, in preparation for this, just to kind of get a groove. I was listening to a couple of you guys' podcast, and I was listening to Jen Wiedersen recently, and you were talking about the
existential crisis.
Right, but the exomes or...
Exosomes.
Exosomes. And the hyperbaric approach that you took, you know, post career, right? Like, you're feeling like, not to put words in your mouth, but like I'm a little desensitized.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not the empathy, the compassion, the sympathy for normal people. Like I'm not. And so, I mean, I was very similar on that approach. So I started asking questions. I think, okay, what's the next step? Mm-hmm. And that led me down. Away from the X's and O's, which I kind of thought was going to be the path, into strength and conditioning, physical therapy, rehab, how we treat our athletes, essentially. Because, you know, it was a selfish motivation initially, trying to figure out what I can do to get back healthy, because I still want to play. I'm not done. And so I met some people, opened my eyes, played in NFL Europe that next year, 07, ended up tweaking the other side, like game six, I was having this like epic game in Cologne. We had playing the Rhine Fire, and ran down on kickoff and kind of popped the other side. And I felt that same area. So took a couple weeks off, came back and kept trying. Cause at this point I'm like, my body's kind of feeling like it's, you know, feel a little hopeless. Ended up tearing my PCL at the end of that year. And like the last game I played was the World Bowl. It was week 11. Played Amsterdam. I'm sorry, Hamburg. And man, I was taped up. I had tore it all inside the body. DMSO at night, trying to get my shit because I can't not play.
Sure,
it's probably gonna be it. I'm feeling like. So after that experience, get shipped back to the States. Don't get an opportunity to go to training camp, and the Colts are going to bring you back that next year. Like, if you can stay healthy, we want to give you another shot. Like, you know, we let you go because you couldn't stay healthy, not because you can't play, is what they told me. And people that I trusted told me that, so I'm gonna keep rolling. Well, you know, obviously didn't get called back to training camp. Ended up getting surgery again on that left side. They don't do the adductor release on the left side; they just do the pelvic floor repair. And then I'm in Birmingham rehabbing until about December, January of 2007. January 2008, and then I release and then I go and I keep learning and I keep asking questions and meet folks that open my eyes and bring to light that, hey man, like a lot of this stuff probably could have been prevented, training and conditioning probably could have helped the situation, and it became morphed from like the selfish into like, well shit man, like there's a lot of fucking athletes that could maybe benefit from some of this knowledge that I'm learning now that's not common, right? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like, you know, and that was the initial motivation to get into the field of strength and conditioning. It wasn't like, I didn't think I was going to be a career coach. It was like, how can I help?
Yeah, what was your first formal weight room when you had a responsibility of athletes?
So Rockledge High School, where I went to school, in Rockledge, Florida. So my father coached. I started coaching at Rockledge High School in 1993, and I went to high school there in 1996. So that was my it was my home base, and the head coach had been there since like 83. The defensive coordinator had been there since 87. My dad got there in 93, and they all coached together until 2015 when I left. So I came back and coached there for 6 years with like guys that raised me. So that was my first because I'm learning all these concepts, right? I'm going, so you guys familiar with Paul Cech?
Mm-hmm.
He's a wild dude, right? He got his name started kind of in the exercise science realm. Now he's a little more esoteric and kind of much more on a different path. But, you know, initially it was strength and conditioning. And he had an institute he was coaching. So I
the Czech Institute.
Yeah, man. I was exposed to him, went out there, took a course. I was exposed to Gary Gray indirectly through a great buddy of mine, David Westerman, who had a true stretch in his facility that taught me how to open my body up in different ways. And I realized, well, shit, like, if I'd have just mobilized better, maybe I'd have, you know, if I'd have just stretched post-practice, if I'd have trained a little bit more. So got exposed to that, got exposed to Paul Cech, and I'm like, holy shit. I go back into Rockledge High School. So this is a year after I get through playing. And that year was a bit of a journey. I wasn't like ready to go right back in. I was in a similar phase. I'm 15 years ago, kind of where I'm at right now. Like I'm, you know, like what direction do you want to go? When the question is, how can I help? Which maybe I need to kind of size that up a little bit and maybe tweak it, because you guys were talking with Jen as well about making, like, you got to make money too now. Like we want to coach clients. Like we want to be you mentioned you want to be like a one step. You don't just be a stop in their, in their way. You don't want to be like, we don't want them to be dependent on us, right? We want to coach them and teach them so they can use that and empower themselves and empower their families. What you guys are doing is awesome to me, in my opinion. Like empowering families to train where you don't have to go to the gym and get coached hard. No, you can do this shit on your own. If you know some basics and your family gets involved, but you got to make money too. And so how do you combine that? So essentially the NFL money ran out after about a year. Took a bunch of courses, traveled. Ended up taking a grad course at FAU because I thought maybe history was going to be the path. I had an idea for a master's thesis. I was all into that. Loved studying history, and that was my undergrad. Wasn't sport, wasn't exercise science. It was history. So my dad, takes over the head coaching job at Rockledge High School, and he says, I want you to help. Come up and help. And I'm going, God damn, like I don't know if I want to go to high school and coach high school ball. Like, that's not necessarily what I want to do. But let me come up, and I came up in June, and I spent like a week with them and watched them train. And it was like, all right, motherfucker, like, you have all these ideas and all these concepts, but can you put your money where your mouth is and help? Like, how can I help? Well, come help. And it was like, after that summer, I just kind of observed for a couple weeks. And then when school started and training camp started, I was like, okay, this is my proposal for in-season weight room training. And my father, who was the head coach, and Pat Lusk, who was the defensive coordinator, who coached me, and Chuck Wood, who's the former head coach, who's now the offensive line coach, were like my assistants. And it was my first time talking coaching. But it was like the way these guys were moving, the way they were doing like basic patterns. I'm like, fellas, this ain't that complicated. We just gotta coach them how to move a little better and be a little more technically oriented with their process here. Let's maybe not concern ourselves with how much we're moving. Let's maybe concern ourselves with how we're moving the weight. And it was just like coaching the front rack, coaching the lunge. I was coaching the fucking deadlift. I was coaching how to bench, coaching how to do push-ups and pull-ups. I mean, it wasn't complicated, but it was challenging because you had 40 fucking guys in the weight room, and like you're the only voice, So that was a long fucking answer. Sorry.
No, well, that's true.
Yeah, deadlift is not in the high school weight room right now.
Why is that?
It's too difficult to teach the 40 plus dudes, and then the risk of injury versus the reward, because a lot of coaches are still in that mindset of how much, and then the deadlift, right? It just becomes that numbers game versus a beauty contest like we used to express at the old seminar.
Yeah.
And, okay, let's just scrap it. So they still do awful power cleans,
yeah.
Dynamic bicep curls, sure. With, you know, super wide
what
catches.
What is that doing when they catch it that wide? What do you think? Like,
I think it's, you know, like
long term.
No, like I think there was a time where it was like, well, let me see how I couch this. There was a time before we knew what the fuck it was supposed to look like. So I think about like the 90s, right? Like we didn't have any video. I didn't have a CD.
Right.
I had a guy demoing the clean for us who didn't know how to clean.
Right.
And we were like that's what we thought it looked like. It looked like this weird reverse heave where your legs go out. And I was like, oh, that doesn't look very good.
But
that's what we're supposed to do. And it wasn't until I got to college and I still didn't know what it was supposed to look like. And then all of a sudden, Todd Rice put in these videos of the Bulgarians. And I was like, oh, because he had pictures on the wall of like, you know, like this, like these stills. And like, I like it still didn't make sense to me until I actually saw the video.
Yeah. Of a somebody model snatching.
Yeah.
For you to then try to replicate.
I saw like pictures. It was like 1 through 10 on the picture in the clean. And it didn't make sense to me. And then as soon as I saw the guy like actually pull the bar and pull himself underneath, I was like, fuck, this could have solved so many problems if I'd seen this.
Right.
And then we went in and everybody was like, all of a sudden one day we could clean and snatch. And the coach was like, wow, you guys look way better. What happened? We showed us a video.
Mm.
And but today there's no excuse. Like you have YouTube, you have all this other stuff. So there's no excuse to not know how to coach technique, or more importantly for the athletes to say, I didn't know what you wanted me to do. I think it's just attention to detail. I think we were just uneducated because we didn't know and nobody showed us any video. And now all of a sudden you can have it in your phone and be like, okay, this is what it's supposed to look like. This is what you look like.
Right.
Where do you see the problems?
And then let's slow it down. Yeah, I did have a high school buddy that he ended up playing at UT. His solution for the wide stance was to start basically
super narrow.
Feet touching.
Oh, it's a good move.
But then he would just go out to still too wide. But it wasn't as wide, like super splits. It just stuck in my mind because he was a great football player, but goddamn, he can't lift weights for shit.
Well, but do you remember on TV they used to have World's Strongest Man?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So do you remember they would do the axle bar clean where they would like reverse curl it to their belt and then roll it up their chest and press it? That's what I thought we were doing because the only thing I'd seen on TV was the World's Strongest Man stuff.
ESPN too.
Yeah. Mm. And we saw that as kids or when we were fairly young. So like that, I just think that like today – and like so much of what you're talking about, like it exists. I mean, you can get on Kelly Starrett. I mean, there's YouTube. I mean, there's so much information out there that when people claim to not know what they're doing, I'm like, how?
Yeah, bro. Like I spoke at the Glazer Football Clinic in Charlotte.
That's your boy.
Oh, Jay Glazer.
And I, you know, as a high school coach, I would go to these.
What is Jay Glazer as a high school clinic?
Well, yeah.
The Glazer Football Clinic, like nationwide. There's
that's Jay Glazer?
I mean, you know any other Glazers?
Well, it can't be fucking Jay Glazer. He doesn't know shit about football.
Well, he's one of the biggest names in announcing.
Yeah, but he doesn't know shit about football.
Well, you know that.
Yeah, I know that because I hung out with him. I'm friends with him. He knows nothing of football.
But the people don't know that watch him on NFL Sunday.
Yeah. Oh, well, he
I don't know if that's him. I don't know.
No, I don't think it is. It can't be.
But it's
he didn't know anything about football.
I got 25 spots over
Jamie,
in the country.
Look that up.
the one thing Glazer does is he's really good about making friends with players and then taking you out to dinner.
Right on.
And then he gets what he calls the Glaze Mafia, where now he can call people and potentially.
Right on.
Yeah, that's the Glaze Mafia. There's no way Jay Glazer has a football clinic. What are they going to teach him how to do?
It's
personality.
It's high school coaches.
So we did go down to Atlantic City. He had an MMA fight, and he went down. We saw him in Atlantic City, and he got all of his teeth knocked out. That's why he's got chiclet teeth. I love him. He's a great dude. I'm saying he's got his ass beaten in an MMA fight.
Maybe they have 20 or 30 a year in different parts of the country. And you know, when they asked me to do it, I was still employed with Charlotte. And then postseason, you know, I was still on the list. And so I go and show up, and I'm got three presentations back to back to back, and I've got about 12 coaches each, in each one, and it was pretty informal. I just wanted to make it about them and remind myself a little bit about, you know, who's out there coaching high school, and there's thousands upon thousands of high school coaches.
It's on him.
Frank Glazer, legendary football coach from Northeast who founded the clinics.
Yeah.
Going strong for 47 years.
Yeah. There's still a ton of high school coaches in the country that teach multiple classes.
Yeah.
And they also are tasked with coaching football and teaching strength and conditioning. So it makes sense.
We've worked with tons of them.
Yeah, man.
And these individuals, super rewarding for them, and it's a shit ton of work.
Ton of work.
The way we met is you actually reached out to me and said, hey, would you come in and work with our guys a little bit? And that's how we became friends. And, I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I showed up and then we went out and got beers and had some wings.
It was a selfish, it was like, let's use some university money so I can hang out with a guy that knows, that's probably a kindred spirit, it seems, is what I felt. It was a little bit selfish, but
yeah, it was cool. Yeah, so he came in and
we just become best friends?
Yeah, we went out and had wings and beers, and realized that how have we not been friends this all? And then I got to go see him work with his players, and I was super impressed. Not only high energy, you cared, you were in good shape, which is really my prerequisite if you want to be a strength coach.
You gotta be able to move,
be in good shape, have good energy, and connect with the kids.
Yeah.
And, and then I went in the weight room. We were just kind of hanging out, watching. He had some kids that had some, really interesting phantom injuries, which I call them, which are, injuries that are easily abated if you just kind of do the detective work. And got these kids going pretty good. A bunch of, weird back injuries from just basically shitty mechanics, Showed them that. And, just basics, dead bugs, can you do this and this? And just kind of showed them a little bit of the rubric that we put together for, really it just came on the fly across the football. Mm-hmm. We had to go in and assess people, get them moving, had to figure out who was fucked up and who wasn't. And we just came up with a whole bunch of different movements. And then it came, figured out that the movements that were the tests ended up became the therapies. Mm-hmm. It was
dead
great.
Bugs fucking gold, man.
Yeah. Well, that was...
It keeps paying dividends, too, the more you practice it.
Yeah.
It's gold.
Well, even the fighters, Victor comes in with that back injury and he can't do stuff. Mm-hmm. And it really came down to, can he arrange his trunk? And then that position became so important for us. But and then being able to use it in different ways. But then we got to go out and I watched their team. And I legitimately saw coaches and players. I felt it from your head coach and I felt it from you. Some of the other coaches I could get seemed a little old, a little salty. But, sometimes you need that. But I thought they had a great, the momentum that you guys had, I thought was pretty good going into the season. I was excited to see.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, we talk. It's tough to keep a staff together in modern-day college football.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why Clemson has been so successful over the years, Alabama's also been successful, and they lose coaches every year. But I guess you can do it any way. But if you keep a staff together, that synergy – is pretty special, and it's been tough for us to keep a staff together because we were at Austin Peay. Will Healy offered me a job at Austin Peay in 2016, and we were there for 3 years, and then got essentially promoted to Charlotte. We did a pretty good job at Austin Peay, but even then, we were 0-11 year one, and we were 8-4 year two. And then after that 8-4 season, we lost five really damn good coaches. A couple Power Five schools, other Group of Five Division One schools, and then we brought a whole new staff in January, February, trying to configure that. It just makes it tough, yeah. Not no excuses here, but just So part of what you saw there was a group of guys that are assembled each year. A football coach does the best he can to get a group together and get them synergized, and it's a heck of a thing, being 4 months out of the college football realm and kind of observing what it actually is, from the civilian kind of mindset. It's an interesting deal. This college
does football. It make you want to go back?
Not yet. I haven't had that hunger quite yet. It'll come in small waves. Mostly, it's just missing being around, 18 to 22 year old freaking alpha dudes that are just hungry to learn, that inspires me. They inspire me, or they have inspired me. That's what I miss. I miss that because we need to feel a part of a tribe, right? We need to feel like we're. This is my kind of a little bit of, I don't know if you call it esoteric, but as I analyze, okay, what do I need moving forward? 41 years old, right? Moving into the next 40 plus years, it's like, okay, I need to feel like I'm a valued member of a tribe. If I'm not, if I'm not doing something valuable for the tribe, then what the fuck am I here for? You know, so there it was like, okay, you're contributing to these young, folks. And that's kind of the bigger picture of why, at least, you know, was my motive to do it. And I was talking to Chris earlier, my linebacker coach in college, when I was in the midst of playing that 3 to 4 year experience where I was playing and kind of, but came back and helped him a little bit and interned, and just kind of learned the books, learned the ropes a little bit from behind the scenes. And he told me that it sticks in my head. It's like, only do this if you can't do anything else. Because it'll wear you out. If you can't do anything else, that's coach football.
Oh, shit. You know? That's
and
terrible.
I'm like,
fuck, really?
I'm like, really? You know, and that's like, well, do you have any other skills? Because if you do, man, do that. You can work a lot less hours and probably make a lot more money. And, you know.
Well, I always wondered with the coaches in the NFL. Do they really love the game, or are they doing it? I mean, because I always thought they hated their families. So that's why they did the job.
That's like, a good point.
Yeah, they just, like, the amount of time that they put into the game. I mean, I get the obsession, but I also think it's extremely hard to have a family and a wife and with that level of dedication and insanity.
It's got to be a very special household, a very special woman from my vantage point that can manage that and handle that. You know, Tony Dungy was great for me at that time because when I was picked up in 05 post college career, which, you know, Howard Schnellenberger was 78 years old at the time, and his wife,
see you, dude.
See you, brother. His wife was just a special guy, because he worked all the time,
yeah.
And all the coaches on that staff worked all the time. That's just the nature of the deal, right? You're there late, game planning, yeah. You know, Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday
watching
night,
film.
Watching film. And in high school, the way my father coached too, I mean, it was 7 days a week, and he's game planning Sunday and coming home late most days, you know, out of the week. So you don't really have a lot of experience with dad growing up.
Yeah.
You know, mom's kind of around the kids much more, and dad's this kind of a little bit in some ways kind of a mythical creature that is, you know, this the alpha of the home, you know, and it can work for sure, but it's just
it's different.
It's a different way of doing it. So Tony would show up. Coach Dungy would show up, you know, at 7:50 a.m. Because he took his kids to school.
Yeah,
you know, and he was passionate about trying to make it work for the coaches that coached on that staff.
And he ended up losing his son.
And that was, bro.
I mean, look at Andy Reid. I mean, you know, he lost his son and, you know, had trouble with his other boys. I just think it's, I don't know.
Irsay, the owner of that team, flew the team down on a private jet to Tampa for that funeral in 2005.
Yeah.
And Coach Dungy spoke at the, I mean,
yeah.
one of the more memorable moments of my life, not in a positive way, but powerful, man, because he used it as like a crisis moment to teach, to preach, like we can't let things go unsaid. We need to listen to our children. We need to, yeah, bro. So even then, like, he was doing it as best as he could, and he still, you know,
yeah,
still lost his son to suicide. Yeah, that was. Yeah, tough deal for sure.
Yeah, no, football is hard on lives on both sides of the
game.
It
is, man.
You know, it's hard on the coaches. I mean,
but it's a great fucking game.
No, it's the best. I always joke that I learned everything great in this world from playing football with my parents.
Dude.
Right? Like, I learned how to work into groups. I learned how to work hard. I learned how to do everything. Put your hand foot in the dirt and just go. I mean, I learned everything good in football and learned from my parents. And the joy that I saw my dad get from watching me play and come into the games was nice. I mean, he went to almost every single one of them. I mean, there was a few he missed, but, man, for the most part.
You guys are traveling, Cal. I mean, you guys.
Well, in the NFL as well.
Really?
So, yeah, I would fly him out to, you know, almost every single home game. And if my mom didn't want to go, he would go. I mean, I remember, you know, we were in Green Bay, and I look up there, and he's up there by himself. Dude. You know, he wanted to go to every stadium. And he showed up, and he's like, you know.
Magic.
Oh, yeah. He was he loved it. And he was so funny. He like one time, oh, dude, this is such a funny story, but like, you know, like they would give out the coaches' outfits,
yeah.
right? And the coaches would have their new outfit for the year. And I remember he like said to me, he's like, hey, those coaches' outfits. He's like, you think I could get like one of those belts and that polo?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I went to the equipment dude and I was like, hey, man, I was always real good around Christmas to always like juice those guys pretty well. So I said to the equipment dude, I was like, hey, is there any way I could get one of those polos and maybe a belt or something for like, you know, the coach's outfit? Like my dad's over the moon for it. And he's like, yeah, I got you. So all of a sudden, like the next day, there was a bag and it was like the pants, the shoes, the shirt, the jacket, the hat, the belt, everything.
Wow.
And just in a bag.
How many years were you in the league?
When
you asked that?
I think it was my second year. So yeah,
that's big.
Or it was second or third year. Yeah. So I was relatively new. But I came in and started as a rookie.
For sure. Yeah,
you know, and I was a starter. Like yeah. Like my days of being a young guy ended in
right
my
away.
Second year.
Yeah.
And so I like give it to my dad and he's fucking so stoked.
Floored.
Yeah. So he like shows up to the game wearing the coach's outfit.
Ah, dude.
Right? And he's got the hat on the whole deal. Special. So after the game, you know, where they have like the family areas.
Up, yeah.
He like just comes like walking past security because I think he's a fucking coach.
Yeah.
And he's like, comes in the locker room. And I'm like, dude, what the fuck are you
That's
doing in here?
Awesome.
He's like, nobody stop me.
That's awesome.
And so John Runyon sees him and he's like, dude, he's like, Mr. Wilburn, what are you doing? He's like, I got my coach's outfit. So every year after that.
Got the whole gear.
Yeah. Before when the equipment guy would order all the outfits, he would make sure to order one for my dad, and then I'd have it in a bag, and he'd be like, "How's the new coach's outfit look?"
That's,
I'm like, "I already got it for
that's
you."
Awesome.
And then when I went to Kansas City, same thing.
So first year in Kansas City was fine.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Same thing. I came in and I was like, "Hey, this is a weird request, but the coach's outfit, I need an extra."
So and, was it starter? Was it starter gear?
No, it was. I can't remember who it was.
Reebok was.
Yeah, it was Reebok, and then I
it was
can't
starter remember. For a little while. Nice.
Yeah, yeah, it was hilarious. But I remember when I finished up, my dad was like, you know, God, I was really looking forward to a Patriots coach's outfit.
That's right.
And he used to rock those polos. Oh man,
where did he grow up? Where did Dad grow up?
My dad grew up in Culver City, so he was born in Kansas in 37, and then World War, the bombing of Pearl Harbor happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my granddad and his brothers were all engineers on the railroad.
Okay.
So my great-grandfather worked on the railroad in Topeka, Kansas. And my grandfather went to Baker State in Kansas and was an engineer. And all of a sudden, you know, Pearl Harbor hits on the radio. We're looking for, you know, people to engineers to build this, you know, this.
So dad's like 8 years old at the time.
What's that?
Your dad's like 8 years old at the time, right?
Well, yeah, it would have been 42. Yeah. So yeah, five or six.
I'm not saying 45.
Or was it 41?
I was thinking 41. He was young. Yeah.
Yeah. So
41.
Yeah, 41. Bombing Pearl Harbor. Somebody's gonna fucking send his hate.
It's four.
Yeah. He's four. Yeah. So he's 4 years old, and he tells a story of like, you know, when they were little kids, they would watch the radio. You know, you'd sit and watch the radio because they didn't have a TV.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know, had these ads for, you know, come join the war effort and all like this. So my grandfather and his brothers and my dad's uncles all packed up their cars. And just drove to California. And my dad tells a funny story of them driving through and, you know, they blew tires and but they brought extra and shit would break and they would fix it.
What'd they drive? You know, remember?
They were driving a Packard. So my dad, they had a 30s Packard that was like dark blue. And it was like this huge car. You could fit like 20 people in it. Right. So they had all their shit on the roof.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
all
yeah, yeah.
So
tied down.
Yeah. So they pull in to the McDonald Doug or McDonald. Or the Douglas plant, where they were building planes. And the story goes, I can't remember if my uncle or how it all worked, but basically they drove, parked the car in the parking lot. My grandfather went in, comes out a couple hours later with an envelope and keys. And so he went in and, you know, I'm an engineer. I build, you know, this is what I do on the railroad. So now you're going to build planes. They signed an employment contract, handed them, you know, a couple $100, whatever it was, a signing bonus. And then gave them keys to a house.
Dude.
And you got your first home, and they held the mortgage for your home in Culver City.
So the whole family came?
Yeah, everybody. Yeah, they packed up. Everybody came to California. And like my and they all had these little World War
II. This is December, Pearl Harbor. It was December of 41.
Yeah, this was probably in the summer as the war effort started. Wow. And they all went to California, and that's how we got to California.
What this country did in World War II, I mean that essentially has propelled.
Yeah.
It can't be overstated, right? I mean, the military industrial complex. I did a book report in like sixth grade on the Battle of Midway.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like a pivotal. Like how fast we could get shit done.
Yeah.
Well, the industrial might of this nation.
We had all these, engineers and different people that were doing other things, and they were like, "We need you for the war effort."
Yeah.
And so people, like literally, car plants turned into like tank plants and this, and they just changed because everybody was super skilled.
Yeah.
And and then my grandfather ended up doing that and staying there, and he ended up working on the space station. Right. So his whole deal was honeycombs. So he was fascinated with the strength and the structure of honeycombs. And so his design was like the honeycombs, which was part of the structure for the space station. So super sharp. And then my uncle got in the same thing. He designed guidance systems for the stealth bomber. And so, we grew up in Southern California. My dad lived in Culver City, went to Hamilton High. And then, graduated early and then went to L.A. State and went to USC for law and then was a practicing attorney for 55 years.
Right on, man.
So, I mean, that's how we all got there. And it's pretty interesting origin. I can't imagine listening to the radio and being like, I guess it's a war effort. Let's pack up and everybody goes.
And that was just like, it felt normal.
Yeah.
Like, it obviously took a couple months of planning, right? I mean, to get this thing worked out. But to us, it's like, it's a dramatic thing. My mother's father was in the Navy, and then ended up working. So we're from the East Coast of Florida, where the space station, so Cocoa Beach, mm-hmm. NASA, and so a lot of these plants, these massive industrial plants, moved down into this beautiful climate. Around that, post-World War II expansion, right? So IBM, my dad's dad was like a human relations guy at IBM, raised 10 kids, brought the whole family down from Binghamton, New York to Melbourne, Florida. And then popped down to Boca when IBM moved the plant down there. My mother's father was also in the military. And worked for Pan Am. Remember Pan Am?
Mm-hmm.
Remember that airline that existed for a while?
Oh, yeah.
So, like, the spot of the planet where I'm from, Brevard County, Florida, specifically, is, like, military-industrial complex is its origin story. It's not that old. And every time I go back there, I recently flew in for the first time into Melbourne, and there's still a shit ton of land. Like, the coastline is
packed.
Yeah, but there's still a shit ton of land.
In the middle of Florida.
Yeah, bro. We were talking about like driving up 71 in Austin just the beautiful grasslands and the strong looking cattle. I mean, that's what it kind of looks like in many parts of Florida. So you have this dichotomy, right, of this ocean, beautiful landscape, and especially South Florida, Boca Raton is like this paradise.
Sure.
And then the coastline is like populated with millions of people. You go down in a day in Broward County and Palm Beach County, it's millions of people in there. It's so packed. And then you drive Alligator Alley, and up north in the mid part of the state, and it's like you're in the agrarian kind of paradise. It's a great state. A little bit of a tangent, but
I really liked living in Tampa.
Yeah, man.
I lived in Clearwater Beach, and when we were looking where to move, because my wife's mother lives in Sarasota,
mm-hmm.
I love living in Tampa. So it was. If we hadn't moved to Austin in this kind of area, I would have definitely moved back to Tampa.
A lot of potential for sure.
Yeah, no, I liked the West Coast a little bit better than the East Coast.
Yeah.
I always feel like too when I would meet people on the East Coast, they were always from like North Jersey,
especially South Florida. Yeah,
yeah. And then but it was always and then the West Coast was usually people from the Midwest,
right.
And we'd always call them the snowbirds.
Yeah.
Because they would be driving like usually a sedan and there'd be like a clothing bar in the back with like clothes hanging.
For sure.
And we'd see them come down and it was like Michigan and this kind of deal. But
for sure.
So if is the, because we do have a ton of strength coaches and people that are coaches that listen to this podcast. And there's always this idea that, hey, when I get a chance to do it my way and I go in and do this. But I think what's so hard is the strength coach becomes a sacrificial lamb in so many ways in mm-hmm. professional sports mm-hmm. or even in college sports where, you know, hey, like the team, like I always loved when, you know, a team struggles and they fire the strength coach.
Yeah.
And you're like, come on.
Yeah.
You know, like.
I've gotten real close with Jeff Dillman. Mm-hmm. Jeff was at South Carolina. And the year before the head coach got fired, he fired Jeff. And so that's the story. You know, yeah. It's like things aren't going well.
Well, it's
let's make some changes.
It's how you get one more year as a football coach is yeah. you sacrifice the strength coach. Oh yeah, we weren't doing what we needed to in the offseason. Well, it's your fucking friend and the yeah. guy you hired.
Yeah. So our story, I say our story because me and Will, man, like this guy hired me out of the blue essentially at Austin Peay. I served at Old Dominion for a year, so I was in high school for six. After that, you know, after that introduction where I'm, so I got Ripito's book. Right, starting strength.
Sure.
And I'm enamored with the anatomy of it, and the precision of it, and I want to create a common language, for our high school coaches to coach our kids. I felt like that's where I felt like it was important at the time because these coaches were highly, highly intense, highly functional, but man, they're just saying things that they don't need to say. They're probably saying too much sometimes.
Sure.
Right? Just overcoaching. You know, and so, you know, we start with the deadlift and we're going just starting slow with it. So anyway, 6 years there developing a program in a high school, you know, that by the end of the thing, the reward for me is when I see, well, here's why I got in, right? I didn't get in to get it to do a job. Like I got in because I want to help. And every year, most weeks, I would redefine. Like, I'm exhausted right now. Why am I going back in this arena Monday morning to coach? Well, you know, this is fun. I enjoy this. This game of football is amazing. I love the sport of football. But man, like the way these young men are moving right now and the way they're training, like this is going to propel them for the rest of their lives. And those habits that they're creating in high school and in college, especially after like 8 years of playing football, like those habits are going to be hard to break. And if they're good habits, good, right? We're helping them create good habits. But if they're not good habits, and it could be a movement pattern or it could be the way they talk to themselves because a coach is too hard on them, you know, like that shit's going to be hard to break. So
sure.
You got a great responsibility. So anyway, after 6 years, my dad retires, my brother, who was a senior at the time, graduated, and it's like, okay, you know, what do I do now? Started making some calls and this is kind of just paying homage to people that have helped me along the way. Tom Telesco is the GM for the Chargers. And I called him, emailed him first, got with the secretary, and he called me back in like a day. And we talked for like 45 minutes. And he was the player personnel director at the Colts when I was there. I think mm-hmm. pro personnel was his title. And man, we talked for like, you know, 30 minutes. It was 34 minutes. And what he said was, okay, you can go X's and O's, or you can go strength and conditioning. What I'll tell you is that the performance realm right now is getting ready to explode. This is like 2014. It's like sports science, data science, this thing's going to explode. We're probably not going to hire that many more football coaches. We're not going to expand that realm maybe, but this performance realm, we're going to expand this. There's going to be a lot more job opportunities. And then when I called Rich Howell, who's the head strength coach at the Colts at the time, he's like, yeah, I got two guys that interned for us at the Colts in the early 2000s. They're looking for an entry-level job, entry-level position. And it was kind of as easy as that, right? Like I just popped into college. I didn't really plan it out. It's just a few phone calls, you know, flew up for an interview and said, yeah, let's give this thing a shot. So I made like $18,000 that first year. I was like 32 years old. And I go up there and after a year of work there, I'm saying all this because maybe the young coaches or people are like, not to say I have the advice, but like if you do great work where you're at,
yeah,
you know, like let that speak louder than anything else. Let it speak louder than your words. Let it speak louder than your resume, in my opinion. Because the people that you're in the foxhole with, the people that you go to work with on a daily basis, they know you better than anybody else.
Yeah.
And if they will call on your behalf, without even really you asking, like that's to me like the sign. And if they're not willing to call, then maybe you're not fucking doing a good enough job.
Or they call and they say this guy's a piece of shit.
This guy's not doing a good job.
Yeah, no, I've never regretted doing a good job for something, even if I got like, you know, a host on something, or you know, like the money wasn't right or with this. Like I'll always do a good job.
Integrity.
And I've dealt with people in business that have not done good jobs, and you paid them an honest wage, and they've not done good. And I remember those people. And at that point, you kind of start voting for the ruination.
Amen, brother. So Charles Bankins, who's at Memphis now, coaching special teams, he called Will. So he was Will's running back coach at Richmond when Richmond won the national championship in 2009. Mike London was the head football coach. Mike London's now at William and Mary. They beat our ass this year in fucking week two. One double A team comes in our play. They don't beat our ass, but they beat us. They had a scheme put in. It was their first game, and it was our second game. We actually played a week zero game. We played FAU, my alma mater, and lost that game this past year. Won three games. A tough year on a lot of levels. But so Bankins called Will because Will just got this head coach job at Austin Peay, and said, "Hey man, I need a strength coach, you know." And Banks like, "Hey man, I rubbed shoulders with this guy at Old Dominion for a few months, like check him out, you know." So I flew out there to Clarksville, Tennessee, and met Will and his. It was just a little bit bigger than this. And there was like eight guys around it, all young. The oldest guy was like probably 34, and the head coach Will's 29. And so I pop in this thing. I'm like, and these dudes are like pretty authentic, man. They seem hungry. They seem excited. Let me pop on this thing and let's get this thing rolling. So. Love him. Will's down in UCF now. We talked about that before, but
he'll be a head coach again.
Yeah, I mean,
he's
a stud.
Yeah, I liked him. I liked his energy. I think the only thing I would have said is I felt like he was a little young, and I think with some of the coaching stuff, especially with like an older staff like that, you got to be a little bit more tight to the chest with some of the stuff, just because I think I don't know, these guys are fucking old and prickly, and you know they probably look at this young guy, but I liked him. I thought he had a good scheme. I thought he had good energy, and when I talked to him, he was super switched on. So he'll be a head coach again.
I agree.
I think firing him mid-year is a fucking like the worst thing you can do to these guys.
Tough, bro, man.
Yeah, it is. It's so disrespectful. And I know it. Like, oh, you know, we got to get the recruits. It's full of shit. Because if anything, and like, let's say for example, if I'm a high school recruit. And, you know, these guys are recruiting me and they get let go at the end of the season. I realize that they want to get a jump on recruiting and all that. But especially with the portal stuff, I don't think that exists anymore. It's bullshit.
The portal stuff, man, we can get into that too. I've seen some stuff these past few years.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Well, I mean, the biggest issue that I felt like you guys were running at was the fact that the athletic director and the kind of the people that, you know, cash the checks and write all that stuff. Not big football people.
Alignment is so important.
Yeah, you got to have people like, I mean, can you imagine like the ADs at Alabama? Like they just, whatever you need, Mr. Saban, happy to do it. You know?
Alignment, bro. Like, and I, you know, I've learned to be tactful over the years, right? But to me, if you're in a leadership position, administrative, executive branch, so to speak, and you're leading people that are doing jobs that you've never done. Like, you're inherently at a massive disadvantage. And so, you know, I've loved getting into Jocko's writings and the dichotomy of leadership. I read that 2 years ago. It's just the application and how these guys go into, you know, private companies around the country and just apply basic principles, which, you know, servant leadership, you know, showing people that you're humble enough to realize, I don't know what you're doing, but I want to learn because I'm here for you. Like I'm in a leadership position. I'm here for you. Let me help you do your job. And I think it helps so much if those people have actually done the fucking job.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not a prerequisite necessarily, but I think you're at an inherent disadvantage. It's like being a football coach if you haven't played football before.
Yeah.
You can do it. You know, and being in good shape as a strength coach, like it's a prerequisite. I agree. If you can't if you can't move, if you can't demonstrate these movements, that's a disadvantage, man. Like, sure, you have YouTube and you have the Bulgarians, you can watch clean, but man, that's, anyway, alignment's important, man. And you know, everybody at Charlotte these past, you know, 4 years, most people that were in the positions they were in, it was their first opportunity, right? To be ahead something, whatever the position, athletics director, associate athletics director, et cetera, head coach, you know. The last conversation Will and I had, and I'm going to go down and spend some time with him soon in Orlando's, you know, we had on the job training for the past 7 years, and we sure as hell learned a lot.
Yeah, no, he'll get another crack at it. He's you know, to have that level of experience in that, I think he's gotten a bad situation.
Yeah, and you know, and not to use excuses, but God dang, man, when you lose coaches,
yeah,
you know, and we were somewhat, I think.
Well, I mean, like. It's difficult. Like, I'll just give you an example. The guy that recruited me and was my offensive line coach for 4 years ends up taking another job and leaves and goes to like
at Cal.
Yeah, at Cal.
And right away before you signed?
Like no. So right before my senior year.
So you had 3 years with him?
4 years. So I redshirted, and then he was my offensive line coach for 4 years. And then right before my senior year, he goes and takes a, you know, coordinator job and gets out, and they bring in a guy who you know, was kind of a old guy named Monty Clark. He had been played for the Niners back in like the 60s and the 70s, and then coached with Bill Walsh at the Niners, and was a head coach for Detroit Lions, mm-hmm. and was like in his 70s, right. You know, and they
probably his last job.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's definitely his last job, and he didn't really want to take the job either. You know, shows up to do the press conference at Cal wearing a red sweater, which, you know, there's like basically if you go to a Cal football game or basketball game, whatever, and somebody walks by in a red shirt, it's like take off that red shirt.
Right?
Yeah, at Stanford. So he had coached with Bill Walsh at Stanford and been a Niners guy. Shows up to do the Cal press conference.
Tactful.
No, super untactful. And when I met him, I kind of laughed and I was like, is this guy really wearing a red sweater? And he's like, wow, what's wrong with the red sweater? And I was like, well, I'm telling you, and saw nothing wrong with it. And came out and was trying to teach us some like 1960s, 1970s blocking, like forearm blocks using the flipper. Before, because you couldn't use your hands.
Flipper.
So came out and was like, you know, the problem with you kids today is you don't know how to use the flipper block.
Jeez, oh me.
Oh shit, dude. Was teaching us like this archaic form of football. And I was like, you got to be fucking kidding me. So he wanted us
what
to
year
like.
Was this? This was 98.
Eight. So he wanted us to come off the ball and deliver a blow, and I was like, you know, with the flipper. And so I remember a bunch of the scouting reports was like, plays too close on people, and I was like, well,
doesn't use his hands well.
Yeah, it doesn't use his hands, and it just was a complete shit show. And it just was such a bad
fit.
That
was still going on in the 90s and early, even early 2000s. Yeah. I think FAU, we brought a guy in, John Bach, who played for Howard at Louisville, year two or three, and started teaching these guys to use their hands, and it was totally new.
Yeah,
and there was still a coach that came after him that was teaching the flipper.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
In 2006,
when I went out and hung out with you guys, your offensive line coach was pretty switched on. I thought he taught.
He's not the head coach at Lamar,
is he? Yeah,
he's right down the road.
I thought he did a good job.
Pete Russell,
you know, I thought some of his footwork stuff and the way he was teaching the pass sets and this. Was more about him teaching a system more than him working with the individuals he had.
Mm-hmm.
So I think on the offensive line, there's two schools of thought. Like, hey, this is what I do.
Right.
You know, you're a Howard Mudd guy. This is what I'm going to do.
Right.
And I'm going to try to force everybody into my shitty system. What I like to do is look and say, like, who are the athletes I have? Who are the offensive line I have?
Coach your guys.
And then let me coach him to be the best version of himself.
That's kind of National Football League, though, right?
I mean, no.
It can be done in college.
That's when I came in the NFL, that's how it was, where, you know, hey, this is how we want
it's
it
just done. Better coaching, right?
No, but, I mean, when I came in, Andy Reid, you know, came from Green Bay and wanted us to basically block everything the way that the Packers had. And they were, you know, not nearly as athletic, so what they were asking us to do was basically, you know, jump set and do a lot of shit. And I'm, like, looking at this, and I'm like, this is stuff that I would do if I wasn't a very good athlete.
Right.
And so I, maybe in my infinite wisdom, was like, you know what? And I remember when I came in as a tackle, he was giving me all this film, and I remember being like, you have any like 6'5", 300-pound white dudes I can watch? Because you're showing me like these 6'8" fucking monsters. And so my offensive line coach was like, oh, it's pretty good. Yeah. And I was like, well, dude, like, here's the skill set. And I think as time went on, I got a little bit, I'm like, well, you know what? You can ask me to do this, but I can do this better.
Right.
And so I really think what happens is you either have a system and we're like, this is how everybody does it, and I'm just going to jam a bunch of square pegs into round holes. Or you look to say, hey, I'm going to get the most athletic, the biggest, the strongest, the guy that moves the best in space, and then I'm going to teach him angles, and then I'm going to like find the most efficient way from him to get here and here. So, for example, if I'm playing left tackle and I'm fairly athletic, I can be able to like, you know, go here and here. If I'm not very athletic, I'm going to have to go straight back. Or if I'm really good athletic, I can go straight back and just fucking out-athlete people. Right.
You know? But you're coaching the you're coaching 100%. The person.
I coach. I would draft, especially with the offensive line stuff, I would draft the, you know, the guy that's got the quickest feet, the biggest hand, or, you know, big punch, big hands. I would look for a bunch of intangibles and the guy that moves well in space, and then pretty much bring him in, put him into his position, teach him angles, and be like, okay, you got a 3, a 5, and a 7-step drop. This is your run.
Yeah.
Teach him all the position, like all the plays.
Yeah.
So what I didn't like, and they used to do this, being like, hey.
You only got to know this.
Yeah.
This is what you got to know.
It's a run play or a pass play.
Yeah.
Like just doesn't fucking matter. So I knew, let's say, like, for example, it was a 5-step drop. I knew what the routes were. So if the guy had to, like, wait for an extra hitch to let that guy, you know, give his head nod and come in, I knew I had to hold a little bit longer. So teach guys a little bit, being like, this is going to be a long 5. It's going to be a short 5-7. So, you know, like, give guys understanding and then allow them to go out and do what they can.
Yeah.
And I really think if you do that, you end up doing a lot better. And I think the one, not the one criticism I would have, because I was only there for 2 days watching, but I felt like he was trying to have guys do certain things that were outside their skill set, or maybe not, or not far enough outside their skill set.
Right on. So I mean, that's pretty advanced, right? If you're able to take, you know, what the person does well, and say let's enhance that as opposed to fit this specific way of doing things.
Yeah, but it's the Henry Ford way our schools work, right? I want to teach a bunch of like information so that I can just jam you in like a cog, opposed from teaching critical thinking and how to move through space.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is in the way the NFL works today, you know, it's so pass oriented, and there's so much information coming at these guys with these schemes that, you know, I think football's evolved into this, and you know, guys can kind of go out and dance a little bit. But
I love that word dance.
Yeah,
and there's not much more beautiful on a football field than seeing 300-pound dudes, massive humans, move in space and change direction. I just love the fact that most NFL teams, these guys don't wear braces on their knees.
No.
You know, the college game has gotten, it's fascinating. We talked about this a little bit, but the ankle tape thing, the knee brace thing, like how we just...
Well, it's
one person's doing it, so it probably needs to be doing it. And then we're just selling a product.
What they're doing is they're trying to fix an immediate problem, right? So like, oh my God, the check engine light went on. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to put tape over it.
Yeah.
Which is what they were doing. Like, oh, roll tankles. But yeah, do they know that like when you fucking lock your ankles down, they lose all this mobility. Dude. There's all these problems. Dude. I would get my ankles taped 3 hours ahead of time.
Love it.
And I would squirt water in them.
Love it.
And I would get them nice and loose.
Yeah, man.
And, you know, same with, like, the knee brace stuff, dude. I was like, man, like, we had to wear those in college.
It's so hard to
fucking move. Oh, yeah. It was like we were, like, the Forrest Gump.
Like, running with that?
Yeah.
Changing direction? Yeah. Like a screen pass, for example?
Yeah.
You got to change direction in space?
Click, 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 click. It sounded like horses running because you would hear the knee braces click together.
I'm a safety or a linebacker. I'm laughing at that shit, man. Like,
and then the other thing, too, is... the other day, I don't know if you guys, I think I was telling you that they were showing a clip of one of the guys running at the combine.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid had like a huge lower body, like kind of narrow up the body.
Yeah, yeah.
And the coaches, or the guy, the announcer was like, oh, look at that bubble butt.
Yeah.
That kid, look at that, you know, this. That's the last fucking kid I would have drafted.
Mm.
If you look at all of like the really fast big dudes, they're usually like smaller ankle, higher calf, big quad, like horses.
Still see their Achilles tendon.
Yeah. Like when I look and I see cankles, I would never touch that guy. Or real low height, like real like calves that start here and like in the middle of the Achilles.
Right.
No. You want like big, like Tark Glenn was a classic example. I played with Tark in college.
Yeah.
Big T, fucking huge ass, huge legs, kind of small ankles.
He was like 360, wasn't he?
Fucking super athletic. Massive. Like a dancing bear. Like a dancing bear. We used to joke and call him a dancing bear. You know, he's one of the professor ADs up at Berkeley.
Is he back?
Yeah. No, he went there. He finished up. He got his PhD. And last time I was up there, I saw him, and I haven't laughed. Like, it was one of those things. I turned the corner because we went up to go. Why were we up there? Oh, I went up to go see Cal Strength and Dave Spitz, and we decided to swing by and see him. And I rounded the corner, and I hadn't seen him in years. You know, we played college football together, and obviously when I'd see him when we played the Colts, and we just started laughing. And I hadn't laughed that hard in a long time, just busting his balls.
You could tell right away. And I was only there for 18 months, but what a great personality. And those guys are always good to me.
Yeah.
And this is probably fortuitous, but, you know, the offensive linemen, for whatever reason, were always like my dudes. I rock with those dudes, man. So, you know, Ryan Dean was right. Targ was left.
Yep.
Jeff was center. And Dylan Gandy, who's actually from Pflugerville right outside of Austin, was rotating in that year. But Ryan Deem and Jake Scott. Jake was from Utah, I think.
Yeah.
Ryan Liljoe was from Kansas City. He was
So Liljoe was on our practice squad.
Kansas City.
They saw, and he could play.
Yeah, man.
He came
athletic.
In. Yeah, he came in. Well, played
had to
as
be
a
at that scheme, right?
And then Howard what's crazy, Mudd. Yeah, with Mudd stuff, and then they took him to the Colts, and then he went back to KC and got
paid. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, we knew in training camp, like, it's one of those things in the NFL, man. You can either play or you can't, and you know whether or not guys can play pretty quick.
Right.
Yeah. So, would you ever go back to being an X's and O's coach, or you think you're a strength coach?
Yeah, I'm sinking into this right now, these next 8 months
not to cut you off, but, and I told you this, your level of detail and attention, I was like, man, I don't know why you're not a head coach.
Mm. Yeah.
You're fucking organized enough to do it.
It was 8 years ago. I had that conversation with Telesco, and I was coordinating the offense in high school. And it's high school, but, you know, the high school that we coached at, and this is my father, and he'd been coaching with the guys, they're professional high school football coaches. And some high schools, you know, not necessarily like that, but there's a lot that are. And these guys game plan. I mean, they were just as organized, as detailed as any coaches that I've ever been around. And that's where I started, you know, coaching. And so, you know, I was coordinating the offense the last 3 years, really, calling the plays, and the 4 years coordinating and kind of calling the pass plays in 1 year. So, I mean, I loved it, but I could also see how, with my mind, it would be hard to balance, you know, anything else outside of it. It's hard to, it's just, because I love, I mean, I played football since 5 years old. I've been around football for, you know, 35 Forever. Years, my whole life, really. I played 20, and I've coached for 15. So, like, certainly I can go back into it. I'm thankful that I've hesitated, because these next 8 months, I want to make sure that I'm going to make the right decision, right, and move in the direction that makes sense. Because I want a family, man.
Yeah.
You know, and it's being around you guys has been just beautiful, man. I'm humbled.
I'm glad you had fun. You got to see a little bit
beautiful girls, man.
A little slice of going to jiu-jitsu, talking shit in the car, coming home, you know, trying to do the Chinese fire drill to, like, you know, get dinner made and all this, and Legos and that, and, like, trying to manage it all. It's
I love
a lot.
The personalities of the twins, how different they are, man. So cool.
And they battle nonstop. It's funny. And then and then Jamie's riding Cash, and they're talking, like, it's just.
So
that's
anyway,
fine. Yeah, they're good kids.
So
I feel very lucky.
How to have a family, right? And what's really important? And I didn't start this thing 15 years ago to say I want to get a job. I started this
I think
thing to
the
help.
Most important thing is you got to find a wife or somebody to have kids with that's like an equal partner and is pretty switched on.
For
like,
sure.
Like, pretty sharp, organized, like has some suits that you don't.
For sure.
And I think having kids is great, but I can't imagine having those kids without my wife.
You can't.
No, there's no way. Like, there's 4,000 things that she somehow has in her spreadsheet in her head, and I keep track of four.
In this country, too, how intense this country is, too, right? I mean, we only know it, but, I mean, just the you talk about switched on. I mean, it's Monday, Friday. I mean, it's sunrise to sundown, man, and you're getting back from jiu-jitsu last night at 8 o'clock. I mean, the things are rolling fast. It's a business, man. You're running a business out of the home. So...
No, but it's good because like, I want my kids to remember, like, I think it's important for them. I'll just give you, for example, for jiu-jitsu, like, they like the fact that, like, I'm just not sitting there watching them.
Yeah, man.
Like, you know, yeah, like, it's I think kids have to see their parents do, you know, like, you know, like obviously like, you know, Kate training and this and the gym and the kind of the environment, they know that, you know, fitness and training and food and all the things that we do are all important. And I think, I don't know, I can't imagine doing it any other way.
But no, it's beautiful.
I'm excited to see what you do, dude. I appreciate your thoughtful nature and the fact that you're like slow playing a little bit. I'm sure you could have jumped right in and, you know, gone somewhere and had another job.
I could have got a job. But I don't just want a job, you know. I feel like I want to
do something amazing.
Yeah, well, the entrepreneurial thing is out of my comfort zone. But, you know, as I've reflected kind of got myself and kind of sunk into this uncomfortable time, there's possibilities that are opening into my field of vision. You know, ways that you can, to use business language, how can you leverage your experience to create value that can be, you know, rewarded with payment? I mean, it's not, the concept's not that complicated, but you know, but entering into the space and, you know, is so part of what I wanted to come out to Austin. There's a lot of moving and shaking out here, man. There's a lot of people making things happen outside of the general structure.
Yeah, sure.
You know, the first stops was on it, and you know, just cruised around their gym, just kind of want to see what was going on. And right next to them was a place called Kuya, I think, KUYA. That was the healing center. Right across from them was 10th.
10th Planet.
Yeah, I mean, so like, and you know, just kind of tapping into that. I mean, I've been a part of teams my whole life, and when you're in a football season, man, nothing else really exists. At least the way that I do it. I mean, so I don't know how to. So if I go in, it's like, this is going to be. Like I know what the kind of future holds, kind of deal. And maybe I'm into it, but I just know. I know how intense it can be, and.
It's good you take a breather, step away, like let it kind of marinate a little bit, and you know, I think the worst thing people can do is this idea that you always got to be working. I know I should have taken a little more time when I retired. Mm. All of a sudden, you know, I'm get injured, surgery. Next thing I know, you know, CrossFit recruited me to headhunted. You know, next thing I know, I'm...
You're rolling, traveling the world.
Yeah. And it was good because I also have, like we were talking about, this weird fear of failure. Yeah. And I was so... it was funny. When I didn't sign with Baltimore, Ozzie Newsom... Ozzie Newsom was a baseball player. I think it was Ozzie Newsom.
He's the GM of the yeah. Ravens for a while. Yeah.
And he, I remember when I didn't sign with them, and I was like, hey, dude, like, I'm not going to play for the minimum. I went through this whole thing. He's like, you're on the fucking street. You'll never make six figures. And I was like, fuck you. And I basically told him to fuck himself.
That was a fuel.
And that was a deal when I retired. Yeah, I wanted to be fuel. Able to come out and show that I could do this. Yeah. And I could go out and you know, port this information over and be able to go out and do all these things. And so there was a, you know, little bit of a sense of like sticking in people's asses. Because, right. You know, like, oh, you'll never be, you know, fuck those people. And, you know, there's this other feeling, too, that the only way you'll be successful is in the National Football League. Right. So then you got to go into a coaching and here. And next thing you know, you're, you know, picking up Andy Reid's food trays. And, you know, maybe one day you'll be a head coach. And I thought, you know, there's got to be something else to do.
Mm. That National Football League, it does quite a bit to the psychology of...
Yeah, it's kind of like little Stockholm Syndrome. Like once guys get into it, like they just fall into the routine. It's their identity. It's what they know. And, you know, I mean, shit, when I came in with Andy Reid, who's the head coach, Sean McDermott was our quality control coach. Mm-hmm. His job was to basically read Andy's notes and to make sure Andy had all the, you know, the massive amounts of food he needed at his door. So we'd see McDermott constantly with these, like, we called offerings to the gods.
Yeah.
And, you know, now he's head coach. He's a fucking great coach.
Brilliant mind, right?
Yeah. But he started that room. At the bottom. And that was kind of the way it all started.
Yeah.
And but now there's this kind of like I always thought to be a head coach because I always thought being a head coach would be I liked the idea of that. Mm. What I didn't like was the ladder to get there.
I hear you.
Now all of a sudden when you see Sean McVay and all these dudes just like in their 30s, I'm like, shit, I didn't even know that was an option.
Right.
But now all of a sudden these young coaches and this and, you know, I figured to be a head coach in the NFL, you had to be a fucking 70-year-old barnacle. you know, Bill Belichick with fucking man tits.
Right. Bill and, Parcells.
Parcells, who was a terrible body. Like, every time you saw these dudes, they just looked like, and it was always hilarious that they would, like, critique dudes, and you look like a fucking melted candle.
Yeah. How can you still be brilliant as a football coach and maintain your health?
I mean, dude, Parcells was in terrible shape, but Belichick, terrible shape.
Yeah.
Andy Reid, terrible shape.
But their mind is, like, popping, man.
Yeah, but is it? I mean, really?
That's a good point. That's a good question.
What
can they do outside of that room?
Well, but here's the thing. If you watch...
Is it plastic? Is it flexible?
No. If you watch that much film and you're around it and you've lived it and you've breathed it, I mean...
It's your language.
It's like strength conditioning. I can walk into a room and see it.
Right.
Like, you can see the matrix.
Right.
Like, if you absorb into it and it's all you know and you look at schemes and what this person does and it becomes gamified... Yeah. Shit, I mean, kids do it on Madden.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden, next thing you know, you're like, hey, this is the tendencies, and you have a smart dude that can break down all this film. Yeah. You know, I want you to give me every first and 10 that they've ever had for 10 years. Yep. Just like in pitching.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, 90% of people take the first pitch. It's usually a strike.
Right.
So fucking go out there and be courageous and hit the ball. I mean, I looking back on it now, in terms of what I've looked for information and strength conditioning, all the stuff I've done, it's easy to port that over. It's attention to detail. It's film study. It's education. It's knowing the scheme, mm-hmm. who we are, who are the players that I have. We know that if this guy can do this, and this is where the weak point is.
Right.
This is the individual. You know, like, shit, if you got a receiver who's faster than the defensive back and the guy can't fucking turn his hips, then you're going to fucking do these things.
Right.
So it's exposing weaknesses.
Right.
You know, understanding the tempo of the game, standing on the field, feeling that tempo, and knowing, like, you know what, we're going to run the ball down these motherfuckers' throats.
Yeah.
You know?
The exciting thing about that too is a coach from the other side of that thing, when you see the team, it's like, okay, where are your weaknesses?
Yeah.
You know, how can I help you fortify these things?
Yeah.
Right. And then going out and
finding the right people, making sure these guys are this. I mean, I think when I played, when we played, I'll put it like that, it was a baton death march.
It's a great sport, man.
It is. It's great. And
we talk about these things, but like how hard it was, you know.
But I wouldn't have done anything else.
But like, I don't know, man. Is it still around in 30 years? Is American football still around in the United States of America in 30 years?
I hope America's around in 30 years. You know, Doris Keating's Goodwin, you know, her husband was a writer for Kennedy, and she has a master class. And I ended up during COVID buying the master classes and did a bunch of them, but hers was excellent. She's a presidential historian. She worked for LBJ. And then her husband was one of Kennedy's speechwriters. And she has a great point where she's like, America is not that fragile. And that's kind of like she will endure, like Mother Liberty will endure. Mm-hmm. And every time I turn on the news, I think, have we become more fragile?
Mm.
And, you know, there's you hear all the time with anti-fragility. And, you know, you're talking about Jocko and extreme ownership. I mean, what those guys are preaching.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, I mean, there's a point probably in the not too far future where, you know, what Jocko's talking about makes him a domestic terrorist to some people.
Mm. I sure hope not.
Yeah. I mean, but it's true. I mean, personal responsibility, it is your fault. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of these things that we take as personal responsibility in this, at some point,
we learn that in jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
We learn that in sport.
You learn that in wrestling. You learn that in football.
So I've traveled a bit now. And you know, again, if I go back into coaching, like, yeah, there's going to be some travel. There's going to be some opportunity to explore. But it's like I'm trying to catch up for maybe some things that I've missed.
Yeah.
Last time I took a cross-country drive was 2007, you know, and getting on the road and just feeling, or on a plane, whatever, and feeling places and just witnessing.
Man, I really like to drive.
What's happened? I love it.
I would rather drive places than
I'm
fly
hopeful
any day.
Though. Like when I do that, maybe I'm a pretty big optimist, but like when I see what's going on, when I watch those kids at jiu-jitsu the last 2 days training and working, and adults too, and when I'm in New York City, you know, and I run out to catch a sunrise, and I see the city waking up and the blue collar nature of that city, how much construction's going on every street corner. I don't know, man, this idea of America, you know, the idea of the principles behind the United States of America are not.
Well, I think the physical nature of America is not fragile, but I think if you view it, the lens of social media and the news and all the other bullshit, it's not us. It's fucking make believe.
It's so quick. I want to talk about this. I wrote this down earlier. So, storytelling, you know, I grew up listening to storytellers, and watching movies that that painted pictures and told stories. And when somebody asked you a question about, you know, like a concept, and we want to try to fit it in a short, a YouTube short, we want to try to fit in, you know, a certain amount of characters. Like, that's not, we're missing depth.
Yeah.
That I wonder what our children, you know, the past 15 years, when because it's like information travels, and I'm watching young kids absorb this information just so quick and so fast, and they're seeing so much, and us now we're seeing so much that we get impatient maybe, and you're being too involved. Yeah, but there's a story behind it.
Yeah.
Like what I'm curious what's happening, like what this technology has really done, you know, to the psychology of our population. Because there's like beautiful nuance in stories, man.
Yeah.
And
I love a long story,
dude. I started gardening 4 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a story, and it's like the patience that it takes. There's so many lessons there. There's so many things that I think has helped my psychology in so many ways, but it's slow. It doesn't happen fast. And life doesn't happen fast, but when you look at a YouTube short, it seems like it does, you know. And if it's, I don't know, that's a kind of open-ended question there. But
no, it's great, dude. Well, I really appreciate you coming, and dude, it was great to have you. I'm stoked that we get to connect, and I was one of the stops in your tour, and I'm excited to see where you go from here.
Hell yeah, bro!
Thanks for tuning in. See ya.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. 7 legendary titles, including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.